Chapter 20 of the Paradise Mystery. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Stephanie Koenig. The Paradise Mystery by J.S. Fletcher. Chapter 20. Jettison Takes a Hand. By breakfast time next morning, the man from New Scotland Yard had accomplished a series of meditations on the confidences made to him and Mitchington the night before, and had determined on at least one course of action. But before entering upon it, he had one or two important letters to write, the composition of which required much thought and trouble, and by the time he had finished them and deposited them by his own hand in the general post office, it was drawing near to noon. The great bell of the cathedral, indeed, was proclaiming noontide to Wrychester, as Jettison turned into the police station and sought Mitchington in his office.
"I was just coming round to see if you'd overslept yourself," said Mitchington good-humouredly. "We were up pretty late last night, or rather, this morning."
"I've had letters to write," said Jettison. He sat down and picked up a newspaper and cast a casual glance over it.
"Got anything fresh?"
"Well, this much," answered Mitchington. "The two gentlemen who told us so much last night are both out of town. I made an excuse to call on them both early this morning, just on 9 o'clock. Dr. Ransford went up to London by the 8:15. Dr. Bryce, says his landlady, went out on his bicycle at 8:30, where she didn't know, but she fancied into the country. However, I ascertained that Ransford is expected back this evening, and Bryce gave orders for his usual dinner to be ready at 7 o'clock, and so..." Jettison flung away the newspaper and pulled out his pipe.
"Oh, I don't think they'll run away, either of them," he remarked indifferently. "They are both too cocksure of their own ways of looking at things."
"You looked at them any more?" asked Mitchington.
"Done a bit of reflecting, yes," replied the detective.
"Complicated affair, my lad. More in it than one would think at first sight. I'm certain of this, quite apart from whatever mystery there is about the Braden affair and the Collishaw murder. There's a lot of scheming and contriving been going on, and is going on, somewhere, by somebody. Underhand work, you understand? However, my particular job is the Collishaw business, and there's a bit of information I'd like to get hold of at once. Where's the office of that friendly society we heard about last night?"
"That'll be the Wrychester Second Friendly," answered Mitchington. "There are two such societies in the town. The first patronized by small tradesmen and the like, the second by working men. The second does take deposits from its members. The office is in Flatgate. Secretary's name outside. Mr. Stebbing. What are you after?"
"Tell you later," said Jettison. "Just an idea." He went leisurely out, and across the market square and into the narrow old world street called Flatgate, along which he strolled as if doing no more than looking about him until he came to an ancient shop which had been converted into an office and had a wire blind over the lower half of its front window, wherein was woven in conspicuous gilt letters, "Wrychester Second Friendly Society, George Stebbing, Secretary." Nothing betokened romance or mystery in that essentially humble place, but it was in Jettison's mind that when he crossed its threshold, he was on his way to discovering something that would possibly clear up the problem on which he was engaged. The staff of the Second Friendly was inconsiderable in numbers. An outer office harbored a small boy and a tall young man. An inner one accommodated Mr. Stebbing, also a young man, sandy-haired and freckled, who, having inspected Detective Sergeant Jettison's professional card, gave him the best chair in the room
and stared at him with a mingling of awe and curiosity which plainly showed that he had never entertained a detective before. And as if to show his visitor that he realized the seriousness of the occasion, he nodded meaningly at his door. "All safe here, sir," he whispered. "Well-fitting doors in these old houses. Knew how to make 'em in those days. No chance of being overheard here. What can I do for you, sir?"
"Thank you. Much obliged to you," said Jettison. "No objection to my pipe, I suppose?
Just so."
"Ah, well, between you and me, Mr. Stebbing, I'm down here in connection with that Collishaw case, you know."
"I know, sir. Poor fellow," said the secretary. "Cruel thing, sir, if a man was put an end to. One of our members was Collishaw, sir."
"So I understand," remarked Jettison. "That's what I've come about. Bit of information on the quiet, eh? Strictly between our two selves for the present."
Stebbing nodded and winked, as if he had been doing business with detectives all his life.
"To be sure, sir, to be sure," he responded with alacrity. "Just between you and me and the doorpost, all right. Anything I can do, Mr. Jettison, shall be done. But it's more in the way of what I can tell, I suppose."
"Something of that sort," replied Jettison in his slow, easy-going fashion. "I want to know a thing or two. Yours is a working man's society, I think."
"Aye, and I understand you've a system whereby such a man can put his bits of savings by in your hands?"
"A capital system, too," answered the secretary, seizing on a pamphlet and pushing it into his visitor's hand. "I don't believe there's better in England. If you read that..."
"I'll take a look at it sometime," said Jettison, putting the pamphlet in his pocket. "Well, now, I also understand that Collishaw was in the habit of bringing you a bit of safe money now and then. A sort of saving fellow, wasn't he?"
Stebbing nodded assent, and reached for a letter which lay on the farther side of his desk.
"Collishaw," he answered, "had been a member of our society ever since it started, 14 years ago. And he'd been putting in savings for some 8 or 9 years. Not much, you'll understand. Say, as an average, 2 to 3 pounds every half year. Never more. But just before his death, or murder, or whatever you like to call it, he came in here one day with 50 pounds. Fairly astoundingly, sir. 50 pounds, all in a lump."
"It's about that 50 pounds I want to know something," said Jettison.
"He didn't tell you how he'd come by it? Wasn't a legacy, for instance?"
"He didn't say anything but that he'd had a bit of luck," answered Stebbing.
"Legacy now? No, he didn't mention that. Here it is," he continued, turning over the pages of the letter. "There, 50 pounds. You see the date. That'll be 2 days before his death."
Jettison glanced at the letter and resumed his seat.
"Now then, Mr. Stebbing, I want you to tell me something very definite," he said. "It's not so long since this happened, so you'll not have to check your memory to any great extent. In what form did Collishaw pay that 50 pounds to you?"
"That's easily answered, sir," said the secretary. "It wasn't gold. 50 sovereigns. He had them in a bit of a bag."
Jettison reflected on this information for a moment or two. Then he rose.
"Much obliged to you, Mr. Stebbing," he said.
"That's something worth knowing. Now, there's something else you can tell me as long as I'm here, though, to be sure, I can save you the trouble by using my own eyes. How many banks are there in this little city of yours?"
"3, answered Stebbing promptly. "Old Bank in Monday Market, Poppin and Hargreaves in the Square, Wrychester Bank in Spurriergate. That's the lot."
"Much obliged," said Jettison.
And for the present, not a word of what we've talked about. You'll be hearing more later." He went away, memorizing the names of the three banking establishments. 10 minutes later, he was in the private parlor of the first, in serious conversation with its manager. Here, it was necessary to be more secret and to insist on more secrecy than with the secretary of the Second Friendly, and to produce all his credentials and give all his reasons. But Jettison drew that covered blank, and the next too, and it was not until he had been closeted for some time with the authorities of the third bank that he got the information he wanted. And when he had got it, he impressed secrecy and silence on his informants in a fashion which showed them that however easygoing his manner might be, he knew his business as thoroughly as they knew theirs. It was by that time past 1 o'clock, and Jettison turned into the small hotel at which he had lodged himself. He thought much and gravely while he ate his dinner. He thought still more while he smoked his after-dinner pipe. And his face was still heavy with thought when, at 3 o'clock, he walked into Mitchington's office and, finding the inspector alone, shut the door and drew a chair to Mitchington's desk. "Now then," he said, "I've had a rare morning's work and made a discovery, and you and me, my lad, have got to have about as serious a bit of talk as we've had since I came here." Mitchington pushed his papers aside and showed his keen attention. "You remember what that young fellow told us last night about that man Collishaw paying in £50 to the Second Friendly 2 days before his death?" said Jettison. "Well, I thought over that business a lot early this morning, and I fancied I saw how I could find something out about it. So I have, on the strict quiet. That's why I went to the Friendly Society. The fact was, I wanted to know in what form Collishaw handed in that £50. I got to know. Gold." Mitchington, whose work hitherto had not led him into the mysteries of detective enterprise, nodded delightedly. "Good," he said. "Rare idea. I should never have thought of it. And what do you make of that now?" "Nothing," replied Jettison. "But a good deal out of what I've learned since that bit of a discovery. Now, put it to yourself, whoever it was that paid Collishaw that £50 in gold did it with a motive. More than one motive, to be exact. But we'll stick to one to begin with. The motive for paying in gold was avoidance of discovery. A check can be readily traced. So can banknotes. But gold is not easily traced. Therefore, the man who paid Collishaw £50 took care to provide himself with gold. Now then, how many men are there in a small place like this who are likely to carry £50 in gold in their pockets, or to have it at hand?" "Not many," agreed Mitchington. "Just so. And therefore, I've been doing a bit of secret inquiry amongst the bankers as to who supplied himself with gold about that date," continued Jettison. "I took convince him of the absolute necessity of information, too, before I got any. But I got some at the third attempt. On the day previous to that on which Collishaw handed that £50 to Stebbing, a certain Rochester man drew £50 in gold at his bank. Who do you think he was?"
"Who?
Who?" demanded Mitchington. Jettison leaned half across the desk. "Bryce," he said in a whisper. "Bryce." Mitchington sat up in his chair and opened his mouth in sheer astonishment. "Good heavens," he muttered after a moment's silence.
"You don't mean it."
"Fact," answered Jettison. "Plain, incontestable fact, my lad. Dr. Bryce keeps an account at the Rochester Bank. On the day I'm speaking of, he cashed a cheque to self for £50 and took it all in gold." The two men looked at each other as if each were asking his companion a question.
"Well," said Mitchington at last,
"you are cut above me, Jettison. What do you make of it?"
"I said last night that the young man was playing a deep game," replied Jettison.
"But what game? What's he building up? For mark you, Mitchington, if, I say if, mind, if that £50 which he drew in gold is the identical 50 paid to Collishaw, Bryce didn't pay it as hush money."
"Think not," said Mitchington, evidently surprised.
"Now, that was my first impression. If it wasn't hush money..."
"It wasn't hush money for this reason," interrupted Jettison. "We know that whatever else he knew, Bryce didn't know of the accident to Braden until Warner fetched him to Braden. That's established on what you've put before me. Therefore, whatever Collishaw saw, before or at the time that accident happened, it wasn't Bryce who was mixed up in it. Therefore, why should Bryce pay Collishaw hush money?"
Mitchington, who had evidently been thinking, suddenly pulled out a drawer in his desk and took some papers from it, which he began to turn over.
"Wait a minute," he said. "I've an abstract here of what the foreman of the Cathedral Mason's Yard told me of what he knew as to where Collishaw was working that morning when the accident happened. I made a note of it when I questioned him after Collishaw's death. Here you are. Foreman says that on morning of Braden's accident, Collishaw was at work in the north gallery of the clerestory, clearing away some timber which the carpenters had left there. Collishaw was certainly thus engaged from 9 o'clock until past 11 that morning. Now, have investigated this myself. From the exact spot where C was clearing the timber, there's an uninterrupted view of the gallery on the south side of the nave, and of the arched doorway at the head of St. Wrytha's Stair."
"Well," observed Jettison, "that proves what I'm saying. It wasn't hush money. For whoever it was that Collishaw saw lay hands on Braden, it wasn't Bryce. Bryce, we know, was at that time coming across the close or crossing that path through the part you call Paradise. Warner's evidence proves that. So if the £50 wasn't paid for hush money, what was it paid for?"
"Do you suggest anything?" asked Mitchington.
"I've thought of two or three things," answered the detective. "One's this. Was the £50 paid for information? If so, and Bryce has that information, why doesn't he show his hand more plainly? If he bribed Collishaw with £50 to tell him who Braden's assailant was, he now knows. So why doesn't he let it out and have done with it?"
"Part of his game, if that theory is right," murmured Mitchington.
"It mayn't be right," said Jettison. "But it's one. And there's another, supposing he paid Collishaw that money on behalf of somebody else. I've thought this business out right and left, top side and bottom side, and hang me if I don't feel certain there's somebody else. What did Ransford tell us about Bryce and this old Harker? Think of that. And yet, according to Bryce, Harker is one of our old yard men, and therefore ought to be above suspicion."
Mitchington suddenly started as if an idea had occurred to him.
"I say, you know," he exclaimed, "we've only Bryce's word for it that Harker is an ex-detective. I never heard that he was. If he is, he's kept it strangely quiet. You'd have thought that he'd have let us know here of his previous calling. I've never heard of a policeman of any rank who didn't like to have a bit of talk with his own sort about professional matters."
"Nor me," assented Jettison.
"And, as you say, we've only Bryce's word. And the more I think of it, the more I'm convinced there's somebody, some man,
of whom you don't seem to have the least idea who's in this. And it may be that Rice is in with him. However, here's one thing I'm going to do at once. Rice gave us that information about the £50. Now I'm going to tell Rice straight out that I've gone into that matter in my own fashion, a fashion he evidently never thought of, and ask him to explain why he drew a similar amount in gold. Come on round to his rooms. But Rice was not to be found at his rooms, had not been back to his rooms, said his landlady, since he had ridden away early in the morning. All she knew was that he had ordered his dinner to be ready at his usual time that evening. With that, the two men had to be content, and they went back to the police station still discussing the situation. And they were still discussing it an hour later, when a telegram was handed to Mitchington, who tore it open, glanced over its contents, and passed it to his companion, who read it aloud. Meet me with Jettison, Wrychester Station, on arrival of 5:20 express from London. Mystery cleared up, guilty man known. Ransford. Jettison handed the telegram back. A man of his word, he said. He mentioned 2 days. He sounded in one. And now, my lad, do you notice? He says men, not man. It's as I said, there's been more than one of them in this affair. Now then, who are they? End of chapter 20. Jettison takes a hand.